Guardian Unlimited.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. Six businesses, one investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
Hello, it's Monday, June the 25th. My name's John Dennis, and you're listening to Newsdesk. Today, Gordon Brown is the new Labour leader. He promises a party with soul. Harriet Harman is the victor of a tightly fought battle to be Mr. Brown's deputy. A video has been released showing Alan Johnston, the BBC journalist kidnapped in Gaza, wrapped in explosives in an apparent bid by his captors to deter any rescue attempt. In Japan, the whaling season has begun. We'll join some Japanese villagers as they deal with their catch. Also today, after Saddam Hussein, the most feared man in Iraq was Chemical Ali. He's been sentenced to death for his role in a genocidal campaign against Iraqi Kurds in the late 1980s. And in tennis, the former Grand Slam champion Mats Wilander looks forward to Wimbledon fortnight, minus Britain's greatest hope, Andy Murray. Our great hope here in the pod is that John Henley will be divulging what's in his diary column and that Ros Taylor will let us know what the papers say today.
I therefore declare Harriet Harman has been elected.
It'll be an honour and a privilege to work alongside Gordon Brown, our new leader and new Prime Minister. And we should be saying to the country, if it's experience, substance, strength and principles you want, then Gordon Brown's your man.
So, it gives me great pleasure to introduce my friend for over 20 years from today, the leader of our party, very soon to be the leader of our country. I know that he will give of his best, and I know from his record as Chancellor that his best is as good as it gets. Friends and colleagues, the new leader of the Labour Party, Gordon Brown.
It is with humility, and it's with pride, and it's with a great sense of duty that I accept the privilege and the great responsibility of leading our party and changing our country.
Gordon Brown addressing his party at the Labour conference in Manchester. The Guardian's Tanya Branigan was there. I asked her to tell us how Harriet Harman secured her place as Brown's number two.
Well, she won it partly by campaigning very hard. She won it on the reputation she's built up over many years as somebody who's really sort of fought for issues that were once seen as women's issues and seen as very marginal, but are now completely mainstream, such as work-life balance, such as fairer deal for women in the workplace. That was one really key thing. But the other thing is that she went out and really made the case for bold policies. Now, that was portrayed by the Tories and by Hazel Blears, really, as well, within the Labour Party and by others, as a tendency for sort of the deputy leadership candidates to sort of lurch to the left. And she did actually put out a lot of policy. She came up with a lot of ideas. What's striking about this campaign is not just that she did very well on the left. She ultimately won the contest because she picked up voters when John Cruddas was knocked out in the sort of penultimate round of voting, but also that she won as somebody who could appeal to the mainstream. So it was a slightly sort of paradoxical but ultimately successful sort of pitch for the job.
How will Harriet Harman work with Gordon Brown?
Well, she's worked with him over a long time. She's seen as somebody who's been very loyal to Brown. And I have to say, very loyal generally, because if we remember, she was sacked in 1998, only a year after she came into the cabinet. And a lot of her friends felt she was sort of carrying the can for decisions she hadn't made. And yet, when she left, she was very loyal. She put her head down. She kept on working. And even people who hadn't been a huge fan of her said, you know, give her credit. She didn't go out, as a lot of ex-ministers do, and turn on the government and sort of bitch about decisions that had been made or try and spread the blame. One question people have had is really whether she'll be prepared to stand up to Gordon or not. And she said, actually, her experience was, well, you stand up and you tell him when you think something's wrong and he'll respect that.
Harriet Harman's won this election. She's deputy leader of the Labour Party. Will Gordon Brown appoint her deputy prime minister, though?
No, I mean, he made it pretty clear that wasn't going to happen when he talked about the fact that the deputy, Harriet Harman, is now going to be the chairperson of the party. Now, In the past, chair has been an appointed post, and he said that making it an elected post, making it the choice of party members rather than the sort of diktat of the prime minister and the party leader, was something that he thought was sort of emblematic, really, of the changes he's trying to make, the way he's trying to make the Labour Party more democratic, more sort of sympathetic to its members, more sort of grassroots, not just about sending down messages from the top. The other possibility is that he could make somebody like Jack Straw, who's been his campaign manager, deputy prime minister. I think if he does that, certainly a lot of women in the Labour Party may feel a little bit miffed and feel that perhaps that's slightly unfair.
We're already seeing a bounce in the polls for Gordon Brown, and he's told his party to be on an election footing.
Whether it's actually about putting the party on election footing or whether it's about making sure that the Tories are trembling and running round preparing for the next time round, who knows?
And is the party now united behind Gordon Brown and Harriet Harman?
Yes, very much so. I mean, that was the message we heard again and again, and indeed again yesterday, to the point where some of us probably felt we'd heard it quite enough. The message that was really coming through was that this was all about unity. The deputy leadership campaign had showed that you could have different ideas and put forward different policy agendas and yet fundamentally be true to the same values. Certainly, I mean, people were very magnanimous yesterday. Alan Johnson in particular had a lovely line about Harriet Harman. He said, "I thought I was the best man for the job, and I was, but as so often in life, there was a better woman waiting there to take it on instead."
And people are sounding pretty confident, including Ed Balls, who's one of Gordon Brown's closest allies, of course. Let's hear what he said yesterday.
David Cameron has actually had a rather easy run in the last couple of years because the spotlight's not really been on him, his policies, his attempt to change the Conservative Party. The focus is now shifting to the debate to come in the next 2 years between a Labour Party led by Gordon Brown and the Conservatives led by David Cameron. And I think people will increasingly see the contrast between a Labour government united and a Conservative Party which looks increasingly divided and in disarray, arguing with itself over grammar schools, in an increasingly extreme anti-European position, advocating cuts in taxation and cuts in public spending, which I think are out of touch with the concerns of the British people. That's where the debate will happen. And I think in the Labour Party, we are very much looking forward to the election fight to come.
That's Ed Balls. Now, Ross Taylor's here with the papers. Ross, the Daily Mirror's got an exclusive interview with Gordon Brown.
Yes, he's in a sandwich bar. Quite a posh sandwich bar, actually. It serves salt beef with gherkins on ciabatta, priced £4.20. So it's not exactly a greasy spoon, but it's down home enough to have a bottle of brown sauce on the table. And that's where the Mirror took Gordon Brown for a revealing interview, it says, which he opens up about some of his favourite TV programmes. Apparently he enjoys The Bill and Dragon's Den, as well as sport. And what he does when he works late at the Treasury, turns out he orders a Chinese lemon chicken. There's a lot of comment about, of course, Gordon's appointment yesterday, and Steve Richards of The Independent says he's got 6 months basically to win or lose the next election, and The Sun and Mail say that there could be a general election within, well, anything between 6 months and a year, depending on whether the polls hold up. At the moment, Labour has regained its lead over the Tories in the polls.
What do the papers make of Harriet Harman's appointment as Deputy Labour Leader?
There's not much enthusiasm for Harriet Harman. She only very narrowly won the contest by a fraction of a percentage against Alan Johnson, who came second. And the Times and Telegraph in particular, and The Sun as well, are very dismissive of the person whom The Sun calls Harriet Harperson, because they say she's so politically correct. The general theme is that, yes, it was nice to have a woman as deputy leader, but did it have to be Harriet Harman? And the verdict on her, The Sun says, is borne out by the fact that Gordon Brown has decided not to give her a cabinet job. He's made her chairman of the party.
Now, there was a EU summit at the end of last week, and early on Saturday they came to an agreement on the EU treaty, but some papers, Ros, are still calling for a referendum.
Quite a few of them, in fact. More or less the battle lines have been drawn today. On one side we've got The Guardian, The FT and The Independent saying this is a bit of a mishmash, there's some things wrong with it, but let's not go to the country because, you know, frankly, the country won't understand it. On the other side is The Telegraph, The Mail, The Sun and The Express, who all are very keen for a referendum. And The Telegraph says, we won't be bamboozled out of it. It says the two texts, and it's talking here about the new treaty and the original constitution, which of course France was among the countries that rejected. The two texts are virtually identical. There's going to be an EU president, an EU foreign minister, just under a different name, an EU legal system, and the right to enter into relations with other states as a sovereign entity. But on the other side, you've got the FT, which says the deal is clumsy, but still better than nothing.
What news of our dear royal family?
Well, there's a rumour circulating today that Wills and Kate are back together again. The Mirror claims that they were spotted together earlier this month at some sort of army party with a Moulin Rouge theme, and Wills, God. Apparently, Wills is
Can
jealous.
Can you imagine how dreadful that party would
be? Slightly, yeah. And apparently Wills's jealousy has been piqued by seeing Kate out and about on the town with other men, and by the end of the evening they were smooching, and according to the Mirror, they went back to Wills's barracks together. But the Sun says this is all nonsense, and they just want to remain good friends, and they are not going to get back together again.
So now we know. Many thanks, Ross, and don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap for your daily dose of celebrity news in the form of a review of the papers in an email. Do that by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. The family of Alan Johnston, the BBC's Gaza correspondent, say they're concerned and distressed by the latest video released by his captors. In it, he says he's been dressed in an explosives belt, which will be detonated if any attempt is made to rescue him. Rory McCarthy is The Guardian's Middle East correspondent. He told me how Mr Johnston was kidnapped on March the 12th.
Alan was kidnapped as he was driving home from the BBC office in Gaza to the apartment where he lived. It was a short, sort of 10-minute drive. He was on his own in the car, and it seems that a car full of gunmen pulled up, grabbed him, dragged him out of the car and drove off with him.
Do we know anything about his kidnappers?
We don't have an exact account of who is holding him, but the best we can tell is that he's being held by members of a large criminal family in Gaza. It's a family called the Dogmush, who are normally involved in gun running and smuggling, and have been involved in the kidnapping of foreigners in the past.
And they calling themselves the Army of Islam. What are they demanding?
Well, publicly they've been demanding for the release of a Palestinian-born radical cleric who is currently in jail in the UK. Although I suspect in private they have been asking for other things as well, notably money and weapons. And most recently, as the negotiations have continued, they've been negotiating with the Palestinian authorities. I've been told that they've also been asking for a guarantee of their own security.
And his kidnappers have now released a second of two videos. What do they tell us?
Well, this second video, which came out last night, is quite distressing. It shows Alan, who is unhurt, but I have to say looks exhausted and very stressed. He is wearing what he says is a belt filled with explosives. And basically the point of the video is Alan calling on the Palestinian authorities not to mount a sort of armed rescue attempt to get him. And he says that he's been told by the kidnappers that if that happens, then he will be killed. Now, I should say that it's not clear, having seen the video, it's not clear at all whether that vest does indeed hold any explosives. But it does seem to indicate that there is a breakdown at the moment in the negotiations between the kidnappers and the leaders of Hamas, who are principally negotiating on behalf of the Palestinian authorities at the moment.
Hamas now, of course, in control of Gaza. How does that affect Mr Johnston's situation?
Well, I mean, Hamas has had political control in Gaza for a year and a half since they won elections last year. About 10 days ago, at the end of several months of virtually civil war with their rival Fatah, they seized security control in Gaza. And when I was there last week, I have to say that many senior Palestinians said they thought this was an opportunity to secure Alan's release, and that there was a window of opportunity to get him out, that Hamas was intent on restoring some law and order in Gaza for the first time in many months, and that one of their targets would be criminal families just like the one that's holding him. The trouble is that it seems that after a few days, that opportunity is receding, and obviously he hasn't come out yet, and his release, I should say, doesn't seem anywhere near.
Rory McCarthy. Between June the 20th and the end of August, fishermen from Wadaura and from three other villages on Japan's Pacific coast are allowed to catch whales. Justin McCurry reports from Wadaura for The Guardian.
Japan's whaling season has got off to a good start in Wadaura. Fishermen in the village, which is a three-hour train ride from Tokyo on Japan's Pacific coast, have just hours to flense and dissect the second of two beards-beaked whales they caught the previous morning. The whales are the first of 26 the hunters of Wadaura will be permitted to catch until the coastal whaling season ends on August the 31st. Although the International Whaling Commission banned commercial whaling in 1986, this relatively small species is not covered by the moratorium. The stench associated with the slaughter of a mammal hits you as soon as you reach the waterfront. Knife sharpened, about 20 men begin transforming this 10-ton whale into slabs of blubber and meat. At the other end of the animal, work begins to remove other edible parts, including its huge internal organs, which will end up in restaurants and supermarkets around Japan. To most members of the Whaling Commission, even small-scale coastal whaling in Wadaura is a sign that Japan is determined to defy international opinion in the name of culinary nationalism. But for Yoshinori Shoji, a veteran whaler and owner of the slaughterhouse, whaling isn't about conservation, but about managing resources and protecting tradition.
I would like to have many choices. For example, let's say 5,000 animals come in summer season off this coast. Therefore, now what we can take is about 50. We have a problem with these resources. We can do. Yeah, we used to take a minke whale, but it is now prohibited, so we cannot take it. We have no choice at this moment, so we need our choice.
At Hanaura, a local restaurant, the meat is cut into slices and fried in butter and then served on a bed of grated cabbage. The flavour's difficult to describe, perhaps a cross between venison and steak, with an oily, lingering aftertaste. Elsewhere in the village, there's more evidence of the local attachment to coastal whaling. Nobuko Shoji, who runs a fishmonger's, sells meat from locally caught whales alongside more conventional seafood. Behind her store, slices of baird's meat dry out in the mid-afternoon sun. In a few hours, the meat will be perfectly dry and chewy, as traditional a Japanese snack as it's possible to find.
Justin McCurry reporting. Saddam's trusted cousin and lieutenant, Ali Hassan al-Majid, known as Chemical Ali, was sentenced to death yesterday by a special tribunal in Iraq. He masterminded the Anfal campaign of genocide in the late 80s that led to the deaths of 180,000 Iraqi Kurds. Michael Howard was in Halabja yesterday when the sentencing was announced. I asked him to tell us about Ali's role in the campaign.
In 1987, Saddam Hussein appointed his cousin, Ali Hassan al-Majid, who soon earned the nickname Chemical Ali, to head the Ba'ath Party's Northern Bureau. And effectively, he was given carte blanche to mastermind the Anfal. His tactics included the use of rockets, poison gas, bulldozers, torture, I mean, some of the most horrific crimes that one can imagine. And for that, the Iraqi court yesterday found him guilty of genocide.
In the Kurdish town of Halabja, chemical weapons killed 5,000 civilians in March 1988. What was the reaction there to yesterday's sentencing?
Well, in Halabja yesterday, there was a mood of, I think, quiet satisfaction that their great tormentor had been convicted of genocide. But, in fact, the gas attack on Halabja is being treated as a separate case. And so there's some concern among the villagers of Halabja and those who suffered and continue to suffer from the effects of that gas attack, that their case will never see its day in court.
Did Ali get a fair trial?
Well, there have been many, many criticisms of the Iraqi Special Tribunal, not just over the conduct of the Anfal trial, but also over the first trial, which was that of Dujail, and for which Saddam Hussein was eventually executed. International human rights groups said that the political pressures on the court and the general atmosphere sort of put some of the trial's fairness into question. And those who do not question that genocide took place are still worried that question marks hanging over the trial's fairness will reduce the effect of a verdict of genocide.
The judge yesterday said that victims of the Anfal should get compensation. When will that happen?
Well, the victims of the Anfal have been appealing for compensation for the last 20 years without much success. So really the international human rights campaigners are saying you know, the moral and financial recompense to these victims is now well overdue. But when exactly that will happen and who will pay and how remains open to question.
That's Michael Howard. Now, John Henley's here with The Guardian Diary, which has some scary political news.
Absolutely, John, yes. We'll be wondering whether it can possibly be mere coincidence, the fact that on the weekend of the Bruins coronation, this week's Doctor Who gave us a brand new Prime Minister for Britain, thanks to a landslide, indeed barely contested election win. Mr Saxon, who is our new leader, has no policies, a distinctly presidential demeanour, and his first action was to get rid of the cabinet, his second to ally himself to a powerful high-technology empire. Asked how he got there, the loyal Martha replied, "He always sounded good, like you could trust him." Spooky, eh? Spooky, John. We will be expressing even more serious alarm, I think, next at the fact that a certain Jonathan Gottshall has produced in the Times Higher Education Supplement a ranking of US and Canadian universities based on the health and population of the squirrels on their campus, using a 5-point squirrel scale. Intensely alarming. But the University of Berkeley, I suppose, in California comes top, apparently. Several readers and indeed listeners sent this one in, although Dr. Peter Baker of Thames Valley University in Ealing adds that my dog Pip has so far dispatched 8 Ealing squirrels, so I guess Thames Valley University would not score highly were this sort of exercise to be repeated in the United Kingdom. Well done, Peter, and Pip particularly. Keep up the good work. The Sutton Guardian of the 21st of June has our headline of the week so far, which is "Win Jeremy Clarkson's Briefly Owned Bicycle." Excellent, excellent headline. And finally, we will be deriving no amusement whatsoever from the fact that there is in Milton Keynes a solicitor called Richard Nixon, that a reader in on holiday in Viareggio, Tuscany, was confronted with a high-class perfumery on the promenade called Botti, that there is in Bristol Road, Gloucester, a car second-hand and car salesman called Nick King, and finally that the Oxford Times, dated Friday 22nd of June, gives us the trial of a man accused of lighting a cigarette in a barn and thus setting fire to it, who is defended by a lawyer called Mr. Peter Defeu. Well done to all of them, and keep them coming, please.
Keep them coming indeed, and you can send them to diary@guardian.co.uk. The British tennis number one, Andy Murray, will not compete at Wimbledon this year. He needs 10 days for his wrist injury to improve. And he's dejected, but he says he's done all he can to regain fitness. Paul Doyle from Guardian Unlimited Sport asked the Swedish Grand Slam winner, Mats Wilander, who we should look out for over the next 2 weeks.
It's hard to pick somebody, of course, apart from Federer, but I think he has to start watching out because he's lost a couple of times now. Well, he's lost 5 times this year, I guess. And not for his own confidence, but other guys suddenly feel that they can beat him. Because look, he beat him. I can beat him. I beat him last week, so why can't I beat Federer as well? You know. So that's the problem with losing. On the other hand, he's playing less matches, and he's most probably a little sharper than he usually is because he hasn't played. He hasn't won every tournament that he's played, which is good.
I read a comment by you recently. You might have been misquoted. I don't know.
No, I wasn't.
Where you said that the guys today, they lack the competitive instincts. They're not as hard fighters as you were.
No. That's a misquote in that case. I think they're competitors. They're unbelievable competitors. I just think that they're physically a little stronger when you have more power in your rackets. So you don't have to think as much. You don't need to think as much.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they're so they don't, and sometimes that shows up.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't play well, if they don't hit the ball well that day, then it seems like they have definitely less chance of changing their game if they're playing bad.
Mats Wilander, no less. And you can hear our daily Wimbledon podcast at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Today's edition of Newsdesk was produced by Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. 6 businesses, 1 investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
Guardian Unlimited.